It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me next week. Coming up on Central Time, we all know what road rage is, but how about internet rage? We'll talk to a guest about what it is, where it comes from, and what we can do about it. First, Green Bay, the water body, not the city, is likely to see its longest-lasting dead zone this summer, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, as manure runoff and algae blooms deplete the oxygen levels in the bay. Groundwater in the area has also been widely polluted, with Kewaunee County poised to vote for restrictions on manure spreading after discovering last year that 30% of tested wells in the county were undrinkable. Yesterday, Congressman Reed Ribble from Sherwood held a phosphorus summit at the Neville Public Museum with local farmers, government officials, and others to try to start a conversation about addressing the problem. We'll get a couple perspectives on this now. First, joining us is Lee Luft. He's a Kewaunee County board member and chair of the Kewaunee Groundwater Task Force. Lee, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the air.
So you were at this summit yesterday. What came out of this?
Well, I think that, first let me commend Congressman Ribble for bringing this issue into a public forum the way he did yesterday. It was an extremely well-attended meeting. Congressman Ribble told me personally that he had originally thought we might have 20 or 30 attendees at a round table, and he stopped taking reservations for the meeting at 150 attendees because that's all the room could hold. So it certainly emphasized the high level of interest that the phosphorus problems and the groundwater problems have here in our part of northeast Wisconsin. What came out of it basically was there was a pretty good panel discussion about what the farms currently do and what they're planning to do to reduce some of the impacts that they have on the groundwater and also in the surface waters. One of the farms presenting indicated we are the problem, and we need to be now a part of the solution, and I think that was a good first start. And then there was further discussion from DNR representatives about what is currently being done and what yet needs to be done. And so I thought, in all, it was a good opening discussion.
Now, with this groundwater task force, and you've written about this before too, is your focus on, okay, we've got these farms in place, what can we do to control manure runoff? Or is it there are too many farms, too many cows, in effect, in the area, more than we can handle no matter what we do?
Well, at this point, because there is not widespread treatment of the manure being produced on the number of farms with the number of animals that we have, it is a major concern here. The DNR's own documentation shows that we're already over-applying nutrients such that we're over on the nitrogen, potassium, and the phosphorus as to what our lands here in Kewaunee County in particular can absorb. So with the number of animals we currently have, we are already spreading more manure than our lands can absorb. And consequently, we're seeing some significant problems with surface waters and groundwater. Right here in the northeastern part of the state, we have very common incidents of shallow soils, meaning less than 20 feet in depth. Some are as shallow as 2 feet in depth before we get to bedrock. And then, unfortunately, our bedrock is limestone, which is relatively porous. And so when manure or any other waste were to be spread on those shallow soils, it can permeate the shallow soil, go into our cracked bedrock, and wind up in the groundwater supply very quickly. And consequently, we have approximately, of the 556 wells that we've been testing here as of May 2014, very nearly 30%, 29.7%, are now unsafe for human consumption. And that is totally, in our opinion, unacceptable. Those are third world level well contamination rates.
I understand you have a referendum there, voting next week, that would put some regulations on manure application. What would change if that passed?
Yeah, very simply put, all that will change is that waste, typically manure, will not be applied to land having less than 20 feet of soil depth from the surface to the bedrock from January 1st to April 15th. That is the crux of the ordinance that each village, city, and township will be voting on. The reason for those dates, the January 1st to April 15th dates, are that that is the time when our groundwater is most frequently recharged due to melting snows and spring rains. And so if there's a lot of spreading going on during that time frame, there's a very high probability that that spreading could be could percolate into the shallow soil and the cracked bedrock, given the rains that we typically see in spring.
And Lee, before we let you go, do you see a role for the state government in tackling this problem?
Oh, absolutely. The state DNR creates the regulations that farms need to follow. I believe that we have some very good regulations, and many of the large farms in particular have to hew to some very significant rules and responsibilities. The big issue for us is that there is very little in the way of monitoring and enforcement of these rules and regulations. Coming from an industrial background, I can tell you that there was significantly greater oversight of the point sources of contamination, such as a paper mill or a power plant, than there is in some of the agricultural areas. And consequently, the citizens are really the monitoring force. Citizens go out and find things that are happening, and wastes leaving the farms and heading into creeks and waterways. They report it. And then possibly there will be some monitoring or enforcement, but even then it's kind of hit and miss.
Lee, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lee Luft. He's a Kewaunee County Groundwater Task Force Chair, member of the county board there. Now we turn to Val Klump as we look at the impact of farm runoff on water in Wisconsin. Val is Associate Dean of Research at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Science. Val, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Well, we talked to Lee mostly about groundwater. Let's get out into the open water of Green Bay, predicted to have its longest-lasting dead zone this summer. How bad are things in the water there?
Well, in Green Bay, and it's hard to predict exactly what the summer is going to look like because a lot depends on the weather, and it's hard to predict the weather. But in the last, probably several decades, Green Bay has had a dissolved oxygen problem in the summertime when the oxygen in the bottom water becomes depleted. And that's due to a couple of things. One, it's due to nutrient runoff, which we've been talking about, which stimulates massive algal blooms. And Green Bay is known for having what's known as hypereutrophic conditions, similar to that which you find in the western end of Lake Erie. So there's lots of algae being produced. And when that algae sinks to the bottom and starts to decompose, that decomposition process starts to suck up oxygen. And also in the summertime, you get what's known as a stratified condition. You get warm surface water over cool bottom water, and that cool bottom water layer is relatively thin, and the oxygen can be relatively quickly depleted from that. And so this creates these dead zones, or what we call hypoxia, in Green Bay. And that zone can vary from year to year and from week to week even, depending on how hard the wind blows, what direction it comes from. So it's a little hard to predict if 2015 is going to be a particularly bad year, although it does look at the monitoring we've had in the Bay, say, over the last 20 years, that in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years, hypoxia has become more prevalent.
And you've been watching this for quite some time now. Have we taken this problem seriously going back as far as the 80s, or are you just starting to see people look to tackle this now?
Well, you know, I don't think it was generally well recognized that we had a dead zone in Green Bay. It isn't like Lake Erie, which, of course, is notorious for this problem. In the Central Basin, there's been a long monitoring program. We've only been monitoring the extent of this dead zone in Green Bay for about 5 years now. There's evidence, though, that it's been a problem going back several decades.
So what kind of things could change to make this better, to reduce this dead zone problem in the Bay?
Well, the ultimate solution is to reduce the nutrient inputs to the system, reduce the loading. And the the guesstimates of what that's going to take are something on the order of 40 or 50% reduction in the amount of phosphorus coming into the system. That's a non-trivial reduction, and so it's going to take a fair amount of action within the watershed, particularly on the non-point source side, and that means agriculture is going to have to heavily invest in efforts and techniques and practices which can reduce loading. But it's a benefit to the farmer. If they can keep the nutrients on the land, that's money in their pocket.
And I think I've seen you quoted saying, yes, this problem is coming from our farms, but it shouldn't all be solved on the backs of farmers, that we as food consumers may have to pay a price to fix this.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is the part of the cost of doing business for the farmer is going to be taking better care of the nutrients and keeping the soil and the nutrients on the land. That's going to cost them some money. Those costs have got to be passed on to the consumer. We can't all benefit from cheap food. We have to pay the freight.
So assuming we can do this, I mean, can Green Bay be restored to a healthy state in the long run?
I think it can in the long run. It's going to take a while. I mean, we've contaminated this system and polluted this system for decades. I mean, there was a time in which there was absolutely no oxygen in the Fox River because of paper mill effluent. So we've corrected that problem and restored the water quality in the lower part of the bay significantly. This hypoxia problem is not going to be a simple one, and it's not going to be necessarily an easy one to correct going forward because, as you know, the climate change projections for our region are both wetter conditions and warmer conditions. Both of those tend to exacerbate this problem. The wetter conditions mean that runoff increases, and the warmer conditions means this stratified period, the length of the summer, if you will, gets longer. And in the longer summer means that that hypoxic period gets longer and longer, and the oxygen depletion potential increases.
Val, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Val Klump. He's Associate Dean of Research at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Science. Yesterday, Congressman Reed Ribble held a phosphorus summit to discuss the challenges of pollution that affects water in the region. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, according to new Pew Research study, the middle class is shrinking across the U.S., but nowhere as fast as in Wisconsin. We'll find out what's behind this trend. First, we all know what road rage is, that overwhelming sense of impatience, anger when you're driving, somebody cuts you off or drives poorly. It's also called sidewalk rage, evidently, when you're surrounded by slow walkers. Now there's an online version of road rage, internet rage. This is not because we see something online that makes us angry, that's a whole nother conversation, but because we don't see all the stuff we want fast enough. We want to hear from you now. Have you experienced this kind of internet rage, ever yelled at a computer because it was loading stuff too slowly? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate Bradskier is here to talk about what internet rage is, how it came about, and what we can do about it. She's a lifestyle editor for the Huffington Post. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little more. What exactly is this internet rage you're talking about?
So, as you said, internet rage is basically road rage, but for technology. You know, everyone uses technology, their phones, their computers, we're plugged in all the time, and it's just sort of a new outlet for us to feel impatient.
And I'll be honest, soon after reading your piece, I was looking at something else on a tablet, and an ad popped up and slowed everything down, and I yelled at my technology. I'll own up to a little internet rage there myself. But here's the thing. I was around in the days of modems where it took forever to load things. I'd bring a book and read while if there was a picture or two, it would take forever to load. The internet's really fast now, so why are we still so impatient with it?
That's a really good point. You know, we used to have to wait for dial-up, and we would, and we'd be patient for it. But now technology is all about efficiency, and people expect things to happen fast. So actually, as things have gotten faster, our attention span has decreased. According to one study, our attention span now is 8 seconds. So we can focus on something for 8 seconds until we lose interest or maybe experience internet rage. And funny enough, a goldfish's attention span is 9 seconds.
We have the attention span of goldfish. And yeah, that reminds you, there's the an internet meme, I guess, TLDR, too long, didn't read. If something takes us longer than a few seconds to read, we're impatient with it. Is that part of the story here, too?
Absolutely. You know, that affects me as a writer. I sort of know I have a limited amount of space to get my reader's attention before they're going to click to another tab. That's absolutely true.
Now, is this one of life's little annoyances, like on an old Seinfeld episode, or is there some kind of harm here when we're feeling this anger, impatience, and rage, whether it's walking, driving, or interneting?
Well, I think there is harm. I mean, for one, impatience raises your blood pressure. It's unsatisfying feelings, so you're sort of putting yourself in a bad mood by experiencing these feelings. And in the long run, it just decreases your happiness over time.
We're talking to writer and editor Kate Bratskier about the rise of internet rage, our anger, our impatience when all that information we want doesn't come to us quite fast enough. Have you encountered this maybe on the job, surfing at home on your device, on your old-fashioned PC computer? You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Kate, talking about all the stuff we want to know, in your piece you wrote about internet rage, you talk about our desire to know everything. We don't want to miss anything that somebody else might know or talk about.
Yeah, I think this is something everyone experiences. You know, you're sitting at a table or you're with a group of friends and you want to be in the know. You want to be part of the conversation. So someone says, "Did you see that really cute puppy video?" And you want to be included. So you say yes, even if maybe you only saw the headline of the puppy video. And we're just trying to consume information so fast, and it's taking a toll on our brains and our ability to sort of digest this information. You know, there's studies that show multitasking is actually unproductive, so people who think they're great multitaskers actually aren't getting anything done. So people trying to sort of read this article but then click over to the next one, they're actually harming themselves.
And we've talked some about, on this show in the past, about the idea of taking an internet break, a fast. People have called it different things. Do you think that's part of the solution to, A, accept that we can't know everything, and B, to just take a break from the whole thing?
That's definitely a start. I think there is only benefit to take unplugging for a little bit every now and then, even if it's just for an hour, you know, letting your brain reset, taking a walk and observing what's out there in the world, you know, a walk through nature and hearing the sound under your feet of crunching leaves is important. You know, we need to give our minds a break and experience things off screen.
Now, you are on the supply side here. You're in this cruel Darwinian environment that's competing for our eyeballs and our clicks and our brief attention spans. Is there something that you think people in your line of work could be doing to provide a more satisfying experience and make our attention spans longer? A huge question, I know, but I'll throw it at you anyway.
Well, I will say that there is a lot of irony here. There are things that are being introduced into corporate offices like mine at the Huffington Post that can help sort of hamper internet rage. You know, we have nap rooms at our office. People are encouraged to take screen breaks, which, you know, research shows that every 20 minutes you're supposed to sort of look at something else besides your screen, and that's good for your eyes. Something that I have been told before, we have this person on our team that does all the tech work, so whenever a website isn't working on our end, we get really frustrated, and he always says, you know, just go get up from your desk, go get a cup of coffee, and by the time you're back, it'll be solved. You know, he's sort of, it's a funny way of putting it, but you just need to remove yourself from the frustration and just take a break.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Brett on the line in Westby. Brett, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What's your experience here?
I wanted to talk about Apple's Siri, their personal assistant. I find myself very often having higher expectations than what the technology currently is capable of living up to.
So you get you have Siri rage. You're trying to find directions or something, and Siri gives you irrelevant advice?
Yes, or she can't understand what I'm saying. I've got one phone contact in my phone that I try to use my voice dial while I'm driving hands-free, and for some reason I know the contact's there, and her and I just go round and round. She's connected. And since I'm driving anyway, it's kind of entertaining as well as irritating.
Brett, thank you so much for sharing that. Kate, that makes me think maybe it's science fiction's fault. You know, the Star Wars computer always knows what they're saying. Why can't the technology that actually exists in the real world?
That's possible. I think it's something bigger than that. You know, technology has gotten so advanced. Our iPhones and smartphones can do anything. We have high expectations. I'd say I watch my dad do a similar thing. You know, he tries and tries again with Siri when he could really just look it up himself, but he sort of relies on this technology to be able to find out the information for him. Sorry to sort of dump on him here.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kate Bradsky, your lifestyle editor for the Huffington Post, with us to talk about internet rage. You can share your experiences on the Central Time Facebook page. Hopefully it loads up quickly for you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. There's been a lot of talk about income inequality in the United States lately. A new state-by-state analysis by the Pew Charitable Trust tells part of the story. America's middle class appears to be shrinking in every state. All 50 states showed a decline from the year 2000 to 2013 in the percentage of middle-class households, and Wisconsin fared worst of all of them. Mark Levine joins us now. He's a professor of history, economic development, and urban studies, and director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Economic Development. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, here's some of the numbers here. According to the study, the percentage of households in the middle class dropped in Wisconsin from 54.6% to 48.9%, and that drop, apparently the biggest in the country. You study Wisconsin. Are these numbers a surprise to you at all?
They're not really a surprise. They're consistent with lots of data that I and other researchers have pulled together over the last few years. I would quibble a little bit, not to get into too deep weeds here, with some of the methodology of the study. I think they define middle class in a way that isn't entirely accurate. They use a kind of a ratio of earnings between 67 and 200% of the median, and that can vary over a period if you look at the issue historically. I think it's better to have kind of a fixed category and then kind of trace that back over the years to see how much that's changed, say, call it between $35,000 and $100,000 a year, and see how many kind of, you know, fall in and out of that category. But it turns out, whichever way you measure it, the Pew way or way others have measured it, there's been an erosion in Wisconsin of that middle, and in fact an erosion across the country. As you accurately point out, this has happened in every state. It just so happens that Wisconsin is among the leaders, and we see that in the kind of the big takeaway number. Not only the decline in the proportion of middle class households, but between 2000 and 2013, a 14% decline. Really a staggering decline, a 14% decline in real median household income in Wisconsin. And that's, you know, the clearest measure of standard of living. And so we've had about a, you know, 14% decline in standard of living over the last 13, 14 years.
This raises a lot of questions about why. Where I want to start is in this 2000 to 2013 time frame, right smack in the middle, more or less, the Great Recession, 2007, 2008, in the next couple of years. How much of this do you think is the impact of that recession versus some kind of longer-term trend?
I think we've actually got kind of three factors going on. One is a longer-term trend. Economists are now referring to this as kind of a secular stagnation period, secular meaning a longer-term period of time, for a variety of reasons, and we certainly, I think, can talk about those, the loss of manufacturing jobs, issues of unionization, deunionization, the impact of trade and globalization. All of those have affected Wisconsin particularly acutely for a variety of reasons, and they've been kicking in, I would say, for 20 or 30 years, but with particular acuity in the last decade or so. So you've got the trend sort of from the late 90s, early 2000, that's kind of leading to this wage stagnation and the shrinkage of the middle class. Then, as you point out, you've got the big bombshell, the Great Recession, which obliterated incomes across the country. And a big chunk of the 2000 to 2013 decline occurred right in that 2007 to 2009 period of the Great Recession. But then I think we've got the third piece of this, and this, again, particularly hits Wisconsin, that since at the end of the Great Recession, and since, let's say, 2010 and 2011, we've had a kind of an exacerbation of those long-term trends, in part, I think, probably through some policy choices that, again, we can talk about, in part because we've recovered particularly slowly in certain areas from the Great Recession. We've had an increase, for example, in inequality. Almost all the income gains since the end of the Great Recession have gone to the top 1% in Wisconsin, and I think that's played a role in this, too. So I think we've got kind of three pieces of this puzzle, and they all contribute in various ways.
Talking to Mark Levine of the UW-Milwaukee about the declining middle class here in Wisconsin. Well, Mark, let's take the first of those three, declines in manufacturing, unionization, international trade issues. Why would those affect Wisconsin particularly hard compared to the rest of the country?
Well, the most important reason is that we're a heavy manufacturing state. We always rank in the top two. It's usually us, Indiana. Georgia is pretty high now in the percentage of the workforce that's in manufacturing. And so when manufacturing gets hit hard, Wisconsin is going to be disproportionately hit hard. Wisconsin, since 2000, has lost about 90%, about 90,000, or about 20%, 18 to 20% of its manufacturing jobs. One national study referred to the erosion of manufacturing generally since 2000 as being worse than even during the Great Depression in terms of the contraction of the manufacturing workforce. And so Wisconsin got hit very hard by the decline of manufacturing since 2000, which was both a function of the Great Recession stripping away thousands of those jobs after 2007, but also globalization and trade issues, which, again, disproportionately hit Wisconsin because of our concentration in manufacturing. A study by David O'Toole, an economist at MIT, found that Wisconsin was one of the states with the highest exposure to or highest vulnerability to Chinese imports in manufacturing. So as trade agreements with China were forged in the early 2000s, that was had a disproportionately negative impact on manufacturing in Wisconsin. And prior to that, we were quite vulnerable to the impact of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And so you saw a surge in offshoring by Wisconsin companies moving employment to Mexico, as well as simply Wisconsin manufacturers being vulnerable to competition from lower wage and lower price imports from Mexico. So the impact of those trade agreements, the impact of globalization, and the decline of manufacturing all sort of came together to particularly hit Wisconsin in a hard way. And that's I think, at the root of this, what I'm calling secular stagnation.
A lot of people say the story is, you know, the factory closes due to outsourcing, offshoring, that sort of thing. The workers there who once made a solidly or close to middle-class wage, if they find a replacement job, it's in a service industry that pays substantially less. Do you think that's a big part of the story and that decline in median income in the state?
It is, I think, a big part of the story, this sort of downward occupational skidding, as sociologists call it, where you do have profound declines in income for displaced manufacturing workers. The study I did last fall on whether Wisconsin is becoming a low-wage state, which essentially had a similar finding to the recent studies on the decline of the middle class, showed a substantial decline between 2000 and 2013 in the proportion of what I call middle-income jobs, middle-income occupations in Wisconsin, actually about the same percentage decline as the Pew study found in terms of the decline of the middle class, which is kind of interesting. And what I found was that was caused by two main factors. One, a growth of classically low-wage jobs, you know, waiters and waitresses, fast food cooks, and the like, jobs that pay poorly. And so with an increase in those jobs, you obviously have an increase in the low-wage sector, but also a decline in the wage levels in historically middle-tier jobs, a lot of manufacturing jobs that were paying middle-tier wages, which I defined in the sort of the $12.50, $13 and above range, were falling below that into the low-wage category. And a lot of that is because of the impact of offshoring. A lot of that's because of the impact of international competition, and a lot of that is because of the declining bargaining power of labor. I mean, deunionization has to figure into this. We've had a tremendous decline in Wisconsin, which has historically been, compared to other states, a heavily unionized state. The late 1960s and early 70s, an estimated 35% of the Wisconsin workforce was in manufacturing. Today, that was unionized. The manufacturing workforce was about 50% unionized. Today, it's about 11% for all workers. It's about 8% unionized for private sector workers, and only 17% unionized for manufacturing workers. And so, that decline has also figured in the shrinking ability of workers to bargain for essentially middle-class wages. And so we used to think of manufacturing as a way that you could have a stable middle class, a kind of a blue-collar middle class, and yearn for the return of those manufacturing jobs and as opposed to service jobs. Well, it turns out the manufacturing jobs aren't paying what they used to anymore, and a big chunk of that is because of deunionization that's occurred.
Well, now at the state level, I think there's an effort to try to figure out, okay, what do we do about this long-term trend? And in communities around the state, planners, community groups, business people are trying to figure out how to restore middle-class type jobs to their communities. What can they do? I mean, this is a huge global thing. Can we make a difference at the state or local level here in Wisconsin?
I think we can. I think there are lots of things that need to be done nationally, and we can certainly talk about those. I think national macroeconomic policy is a very important part of this process, and trade agreements, and having trade agreements that don't undercut the living standards of American workers, I think is ultimately an essential part of this picture, and that hasn't been the case over the last 20 to 25 years in a kind of a bipartisan way. But locally and at the state level, I mean, in cities and at the state level, there are lots of things that can be done. I mean, clearly we can raise our minimum wage to a living wage. There's obviously all sorts of discussion about that, and whether economists have debated the extent to which that might ultimately cost jobs. I think the preponderance of the evidence is that raising the minimum wage doesn't do that, that we can safely do that, especially since the minimum wage has been stagnant for so long, and especially since the labor share of overall income has declined so much over the past decade or so. So certainly raising the minimum wage is a way to raise living standards and push the wage structure up. We can do things that will support the ability of workers to engage in collective bargaining and to mobilize to raise their living standards. In Wisconsin, we've obviously gone the opposite way over the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, Act 10 took away the collective bargaining rights for public employees, and the rate of unionization in the public sector has declined by about half in the state. That's clearly going to have an impact, and has been having an impact on wages. And, of course, we just passed a right-to-work law, and right-to-work states, the research suggests, tend to have lower wages. So those sorts of policies are pushing us, I think, in the opposite or in the wrong direction in terms of dealing with the whole issue of middle-class wages and the like. And so I would think one thing we could do at a state level is to reverse course on those policies and not only not have policies that reduce workers' bargaining power, but actually do things that would enhance the ability of workers to raise their wages. And then I think there are things we can do in tax policy to eliminate some of the regressive taxes that hit lower and middle-class income taxpayers harder, and make the tax code more progressive. That would reduce inequality, and it would, I think, aid in raising wages and incomes at the lower and middle tiers. So there are lots of things I think we can do.
We're talking about Wisconsin's shrinking middle class, the reasons behind this long-term decline, and what it means for Wisconsin's future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Have you seen your real wages shrink over time? Do you feel like you're leaving the middle class, or that your kids won't have the opportunity to stay where you are economically? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Times Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation with Mark Levine after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a new Pew Research study that shows Wisconsin ranks worst when it comes to families dropping out of the middle class. Looked at a time period from 2000 to 2013. You can join in on this at 800-642-1234. How do you see this playing out in your community, in your own family budget? You're finding it harder to make ends meet, maybe even though you're working longer hours? What's at the root of all this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mark Levine stays with us. He's professor of history, economic development, and urban studies and director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Economic Development. Go to a caller now. We've got Dave on the line in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. You know, I think I make like $13 an hour, and I don't make enough to pay my rent, so I'm forever tapping my pension to make ends meet. And I've believed that top management for years has been doing this, but rather than invest in technology and in our workforce, they always go for overseas for cheap labor, and I've always felt they've been very short-sighted.
Dave, thanks for the call. A short-sighted decision-making, keeping wages low, and he says not reinvesting in technology, Mark.
I think we have not reinvested as much, I wouldn't say technology, so much as infrastructure in society. I mean, we have this tremendous infrastructure deficit now in the country, $3.5 trillion estimated by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Those are vital to the future of the country as a whole. They're vital to the economy. They're vital to productivity in regions, and they're job-creating. They stimulate the overall economy. I mean, there are lots of benefits from those sorts of investments, and we've gotten progressively stingier in terms of making those investments. Even a relatively modest proposal, I mean, I know it sounds like a lot of money, the $60 billion that the Obama administration proposed for an infrastructure investment program, but even that amount, which would be a small down payment on this huge overall deficit, was balked at by Congress. And so as we drive around on pothole-filled streets and as we have inadequate transit systems and crumbling bridges and sewage systems that maybe don't function as well as they should, we should also realize that we're also neglecting an important contributor to overall economic growth and future economic growth. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of kind of short-sightedness. And the other part of it is that, Dave mentioned having to tap into his pension to compensate for the lack of increasing wages over the years or having low wages. You know, a variant of that was prior certainly to the Great Recession and undoubtedly continuing afterwards were families overextending themselves on credit. There was very influential economic analysis of the causes of the Great Recession, and there are many, but one was, one of these analyses was that, we basically had a credit bubble, and instead of raising people's wages and over the years, we essentially encouraged them to maintain their living standards by borrowing and borrowing and living on credit, the so-called let them eat credit approach to the economy. So that's been a problem because we've had stagnant wages, as I said, for quite a long time. This isn't something that just happened in the last 2 or 3 years. This has been going on really since the end of the 1970s, where we've had stagnant real wages in the country. And so increasingly credit has become the lifeline, but you can't continually do that because that obviously leads to the kind of bubble that helped bring the economy down in 2007 and 2008.
Dave, thanks for the call. As we talk about the declining middle class with Mark Levine, we go now to Joe on the line in La Crosse. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think, Joe?
Well, I'll tell you, I just had a situation where I had to make a job change, and I went back to a construction company that I worked for 20 years ago, and their wage price is their pay price is only $1.50 more than what I was getting 20 years ago. And, I hope this is temporary, but I'm very, very concerned about this. I think it's Senator Hutchinson, and it's probably going to go through with Walker's budget on the prevailing wage. Because for us guys that are doing concrete, When we got a state job, or if we got lucky enough to get a federal job, that's where we own. That's the only place we made money. And if that goes away, all of us that are, you know, unfortunately non-union, like I am, it's just going to hurt all of us workers, because that prevailing wage goes away, and then all these places are going to say, "Oh, sorry, we can't pay you anymore, or we're not going to pay you anymore."
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Mark Levine, $1.50 more than it was 20 years ago, and we've got to factor inflation in there. So stagnant wages in his line of work.
Yeah, I mean, declining real wages across the board. I mean, even in occupations where we hear employers talking about their inability to find workers, you've heard of the so-called skills gap and concern by, for example, manufacturers saying, you know, they can't find enough welders, or they can't find enough CNC machinists or programmers. But yet you look at the wages in those two occupations, and since the 1980s, and Joe was talking about going back quite a few years, real wages have declined by 15-20% for those two occupations. If you even go back to 2000, you're talking about, you know, somewhere between 5-10% declines. Again, when you factor in inflation, so you've had, you know, basically no pay increases. Inflation erodes the value of that wage, you therefore end up with declining living standards for families that depended on those wages.
And we'll have to leave it there. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Mark Levine, Professor of History, Economic Development, and Urban Studies, Director of the UW-Milwaukee Center for Economic Development, talking about a new Pew study on the declining middle class in Wisconsin and around the country. We have a link to their infographic over at the Central Time Facebook page.